This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. In 1977, on the 28th of May, there was a rather stunning fire at an opulent supper club in Kentucky. It was the end of my seven-year career at the University of Kentucky, and shortly before my marriage to my present wife. And at the time, I didn't delve deeply into it. I understood there was some controversy, and I'm very pleased to say that today I have two experts on the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire, Tom McConaughey and Dave Brock, who actually worked at the Supper Club. Tom, why don't you give us a little background about how you and Dave became interested in this subject?
Well, actually, I didn't work at the Beverly Hills Supper Club. I worked at the next venue, the Shillings, who owned it, opened.
I said David worked there.
Right. And I worked at January's and Oodles. When Dave got out of the Army after the fire, he came to work with me at January's and Oodles. And the family was very tight-lipped, which is understandable because of the way the attorneys work about the fire and would never discuss it. When Dave came in, right away he told me everything he knew. And he knew back then that it was arson from the go. And that intrigued me. And, you know, I stayed in touch with Dave for, you know, 35, 40 years since. And when new information came to light, he came to me and asked me to look at it with him. And that's when we got started.
Dave, tell us a little bit about your history with the Supper Club.
Started in 1972 at the age of 13 years old. I worked all the way until the night of the fire.
Step back a little bit from that. Move back a little bit.
May 28th, 1977.
I was there. Did Dave get cut off? Tom, are you there?
I am here.
Yeah, go ahead and pick up on it. We'll get Dave back.
Okay. No. As Dave was saying, he worked here as a busboy.
Oh, Dave, we thought you got cut off and frozen. Continue what you were saying then.
Can you hear me now? I was employed at Beverly Hills Supper Club from 1972 until 1978, the night of the fire. Can you hear me okay now?
Well, it was 77. It's 77, Dave.
I'm sorry, May 28th, 1977. I was there from 10:30 that morning. We got there early to set up banquets in the showroom and the restaurant, getting everything prepared for that. It was a large evening that night. We had John Davison in the showroom, held about 1,000 people. It had 2,600 people in there that evening. We had several banquets going on that night. We had two sets of restaurants that held 350 in each one. And about 9 o'clock that night is when the fire was observed, and it was complete chaos after that. Once everything was observed of what was going on,
were any lives lost, Dave?
There was 169 people perished that evening, as well as 278 people injured.
Wow, Tom, pick it up wherever you like. Chance has the slides all set up for you. We can begin with number one if you like.
Okay, that sounds great. That is the old sign. As you drove up the driveway to go to Beverly Hills, it had been around since the early 1940s and was originally known as the Beverly Hills Country Club. Back in those days, in Newport was the early model for Las Vegas. Rampant gambling. There were hundreds of gambling spots throughout the town. Prostitution. A lot of it, we believe, was linked because of what they call the old Fort Thomas Armory. A lot of times the soldiers would get off on leave, go there, and I guess, you know, those are the things the soldiers like to do. The second slide is our book that came out 4 years ago, and with Bob Webster, Dave, and myself, it took about 5 years in total to put it together. It was available on Amazon right now. We're out of print, and we're going to get a second print going soon.
Well, you'll be able to tell us how to obtain a copy after, at the end of the show, if you like, Tom.
I appreciate that. A lot of people are looking for it right now. It goes for some pretty silly money on Amazon, if you look at it. But real pleased with the way it came out and the way it's been responded to.
Dave, was there a tremendous response by ambulances and medical personnel then so many died?
You have to understand, this set up on top of a hill in Southgate, Kentucky, and it only had a vehicle and a half to get up and down the hill as well as leaving. It had a major event of even getting the fire trucks up on top of the hill. There was 37 fire divisions responded to that site that night. Even guys retired because of the fire and what they seen. It was horrific. It was like a war zone.
Well, the road must have been tremendously congested with all those fire trucks. It must have been a huge traffic jam.
It was a huge traffic jam, as well as when they were trying to get the ambulances up to the site. Then there was an armory across the way in Fort Thomas, an Army Reserve unit that had brought their deuce and a half over to take the parish into the back of the vehicles and take to the armory that night. It was unbelievable.
And did they load the corpses into the 2.5-ton trucks? I mean, it must have been.
Eventually, they brought in refrigerated trucks.
That's correct.
From the local beef company.
Go for it, Tom. You and Dave, just go right ahead and tell us the story about the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire.
Another thing I found interesting from one of the firemen's deposition is he compared it to La Normandie, with people coming off the beach, because everybody is trying to get away from the building to give more room for people to come out. Nobody's allowed to get their car because they've got to save what driveway they have for the emergency vehicles. And it's just a sea of people running down the hill. And you could see the ashes and the fire for miles.
Yeah.
Next shows the club about that time from the air. That's in back. That back circular area is called the garden area. There's a garden room there. It's another banquet room where they serve dinners. To the left, you see a white building. That's a chapel. People could actually get married there on the property, go in and have the reception.
Who are the owners?
The Schilling family.
The Schilling family, yes.
Dick Schilling bought it in 69, and his three sons worked there, Ronnie, Ricky, and Scotty.
What was the history of the construction of the club?
Well, it was piecemeal, unfortunately.
Pardon me?
It was piecemeal. It was added on several times. And after Dick bought it, he added on this big cabaret room to bring in live acts and put a new facade around it. So it had so much construction through the years. A lot of the areas didn't have firewalls in between above the ceiling height. And that was a problem for the fire, too.
So it was out of compliance with the building code.
In some ways, it was. And that's the next one is the diagram of the interior of the club on the first floor. The cabaret room's back to the right and the garden room next to it. Go ahead, Dave. You know the building better than I do.
Well, if we go back one, then a cabaret room that, you know, clearly more modern rectangular building.
Yes, it is. Close to the chapel. Exactly.
Yeah.
And when the fire happened and they were pulling bodies out, they were all basically put in rows in front of that chapel.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I'm sure you're going to get into the family and their connections with organized crime or whatever, because, I mean, you know, this is such a striking situation, and Newport was so notorious, as you say, precursor to Las Vegas.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And, I mean, when he bought it for $420,000, put $20,000 down, and they financed the rest. You were going to get into a fire they had in 1970 before they opened. That, you know, one of the family members told me that it was because they wanted to renegotiate. Dave, what do you want to say about the interior of the building?
Well, was this, Tommy, I just got back on. I'm sorry.
Okay. So we were talking about the inside of the building.
Construction-wise, they've done some work. In 1974, they rebuilt and redesigned the Zebra Room, which was the small room that where the fire, they thought, it started that night. The main showroom was redone in 1975. It was holding around 525 to 550. It was remodeled to hold anywhere from 900 to 1,000. The garden area was the same. They doubled the capacity in there. The place itself, Jim, could hold up to about 3,000 people. It was considered a showplace of the nation on the East Coast.
Well, your slides of the interior are spectacular when we reach them. So, Tom, you want to proceed to slide number five?
Yeah, that's the there are a couple party rooms upstairs called the Crystal Rooms, and that's
pretty much the only second floor.
Right. And there's also a basement under the older part of the building. Then the next slide starts to get to the interior. Dave, why don't you talk about that since you actually were there?
This was the showroom back in the 1936 through 1961, and the Shillings, when it burned in 1970, remodeled this and called this the Empire Room. This room here held up to 800 to 1,000 people. It was called the Empire Room. It was just a large banquet facility.
Wow. Okay.
This area here, Jim, is called, we consider this a Hall of Mirrors. It had a spiral staircase that came in from the come down from the upstairs. Underneath the staircase here, behind this would have been the Zebra Room. That's where the initial fire started that night. It was burning within the air handling system and also a filtering system for over 2 hours. And no one noticed the fire until around 8:55 that evening. And the room was engulfed with nothing but smoke, flames, and everything. All the mirrors and the ceiling tile was exploding out of the room when the door got kicked in.
So it had been burning for nearly an hour before it was discovered?
At least 2 hours.
At least two hours. Wow. Yeah.
They're saying investigators that we find now that actually looked at this fire now as well as back in 1977 determined that it got up to 1,500 to 2,000 degrees in the basement of this facility directly underneath the Zebra Room. And they basically say it had to have been burning for over 2 hours. Yes.
That's an extremely hot fire, needless to say. The Twin Towers, for example, were certified by Underwriters Laboratory up to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours without suffering any adverse damage. But there we're talking about a steel and concrete structure. And I take it much of this was actually wood in typical kind of construction of its time. Some concrete parts, I take it?
Mostly concrete and wood, yes. Yes. And plaster, some plaster.
Sure.
And they had a metal roof on the facility. You have to understand this place burnt down twice, totally three times. It burnt down in 1936 the first time and killed the caretaker's daughter. Then it burnt down in June of 1970 was the second time.
Dave, when it burned down, what kind of a facility was it when it burned the first and second time?
It was called the Beverly Hills Country Club, And it was a restaurant, banquet hall, and a gambling casino the first time in 1936.
And were those fires also suspicious?
No, those fires were arson fires. They were proven, yes.
They were also arson fires, yeah.
Yes.
So what do you have any explanation or the story behind the 1933 event?
The 1936 fire happened because the mob wanted to buy it from Peter Schmidt that owned it at that time. He refused to sell, so they brought three guys in. One guy was David Whitfield. The reason why we know him is because basically he had burned himself up in the fire. He lived, but he had scars the rest of his life. He did 5 years in prison. He took the hit for the mob. He did 5 years in prison. He came out and they gave him his own nightclub to run and own. The mob did. In 1970, when it burned down the second time, the reason why we know it was an arson fire is because there was 5 gallon gas cans all over the facility. And that night, the Ray Minch was the Southgate fire chief, and he was called and said the restaurant on the hill is going to burn tonight. 15 minutes later, they get a fire call in.
Who announced it was going to burn tonight?
They called the mayor. I'm sorry. They called the fire chief of Southgate, Kentucky.
Yeah.
His name was Ray Minch. And he said that he was called and told that there's going to be a fire at the top of the hill in the restaurant. It's going to burn to the ground tonight.
And this was another mob-sponsored event?
Yes.
The one that the family told me that the mob wanted to renegotiate. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about their arrangement with the mob, Tom, that they wanted to renegotiate?
Well, Dick had a mortgage with them for $400,000, even though he was using his own money to build the cabaret room and to remodel and, you know, make everything top-notch again. And apparently, whatever he was doing, they decided that they wanted more money than they were either entitled to or getting. Going to get, and made the threat, and Dick didn't pay him. So they went in and they burned him out.
But he persevered and rebuilt?
Yes, he did. I think that's a really tough decision for him also.
I can imagine, my God, when you're dealing with a mob and they're being so brutal about it, did anyone die in that one, in that fire?
No one died. No one was there. There was no electric. There's no fuel there at the time. Two doors are jimmied. They find the two empty gas cans and holes drilled in the wall. And in one room, there's four separate fires. It goes on and on and on, Jim. But the bottom line is, on that event, the Kentucky State Police said the fire was undetermined.
The Kentucky State Police.
Yeah.
Well, this is not a good sign, is it? It's not a good sign. Wasn't this the one where the gas cans were there? I mean, you know, how could the fire?
Yeah, and they break in. They break down two doors to get there, and they drill holes in the floor. You know, it was just.
And the fire chief got a call in advance saying there's going to be a fire, and the Kentucky State Police can't put two and two together and conclude it was arson? I mean, how ridiculous is that?
Well,
apparently part of the problem was they refused to communicate with him. He asked them for what evidence they had, which they refused to send and never did. This letter came out of, he had to write something about it to the NFPA because of the amount of damage. It was like $750,000, I think, in damage. And in it, he just said flat out, I believe it was arson, and here's my reasons.
Well, of course. I mean, what could be more obvious? I mean, that sounds as cut and dry a case of arson as I've ever heard described.
And go ahead, Tommy.
No, it's okay. You know, we got a list we will show you here a little later in presentation of all the other nightclubs and establishments like that burned from 1936 to 1977 in Kentucky.
Quite a string of them, huh?
Yeah.
That's great. That is great. But the Kentucky police haven't figured out any of them, huh?
No.
Really ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, this tells us something about the state of the state police in Kentucky. Yeah, go with these other photographs, of course, show just how spectacular the building was.
It was very well known in Northern Kentucky that if you see somebody taking booze out of their facility that night, that the mob was coming in to burn you down. They let you know ahead of time, most of the time, they said.
So you could remove your stock of liquor?
Yeah.
They let you, I mean, they gave you a heads up and let you know if you were not paying the skim and you were not doing what was required that they asked of you, and that came from the Newport mayor. They call him TV Peluso. He just died about a year ago, 93 years old. In our book, it's very well known to driving down through York Street or Mama Street. If you see someone emptying out liquor or stuff, the contents out of their nightclub, they knew the building was burning that night.
Wow.
You have to understand, Jim, in 1977, the Shillings were doing $15 million a year in that facility. They had the major shows nationwide coming in. Jim Nabors, Phyllis Diller. They had Hank Williams Jr., anybody you can name, they had in that location. And the mob wanted it back. They owned it. They had it for years. They were leasing it to the Shillings in a lease contract. They wanted their building back. He refused to sell it back to them. And then they said, hey, we want you to become partners of ours. Well, no, we don't need partners. I got my three boys. And the guy said, hey, if we can't have it no more, then maybe you won't have it no more. And that happened in April of 1977. He ran both the guys out of the club that day. A month later, the place gets torched.
Yeah. Not too difficult to put together cause and effect in this instance, is it?
No. We also have a letter from the Kentucky State, the FBI down in Louisville, Kentucky, on May 13th, 1977, saying that there were four guys flying out of Norfolk, Virginia to San Francisco, and they had an informant come in and say the Shillings place on the hill in Southgate, Kentucky, they're going to get blown up. Just like the other nightclubs, just like when the Coconut Grove burned down and all that, he said the Shillings are going to get it, the mob's mad at them. They said they had an informant inside the club that was going to one of the universities in town, and he said the building was going to blow it up because they did not like the Shillings. Now, that was done on May 13th. They gave the letter to the state of Kentucky in June of 1977. They did nothing with it. They interviewed absolutely nobody in reference to the fire or anything that was interviewed.
The state police knew in advance this was going to happen and did nothing about it.
Zero.
That was the FBI.
That was the FBI?
Yes, out of Louisville, Kentucky.
Further down in the presentation.
Did you ever identify who was this student? Sounds like he was probably from UK, who was working there, or University of Cincinnati, maybe?
He might have been. It was redacted. We cannot get that information. We're still in the works of getting that whole paper. There's two documents there redacted, but they will not let us have the information. We reach out to Kentucky. We have a new governor in the state of Kentucky. And basically they tell me even now that they don't have enough staff in the state of Kentucky or Kentucky State Police to waste their time to look into a case 40 years old. And my comment to them was, I knew you weren't going to do it anyway because you didn't do a good job the first time. And I said,
wasn't this the greatest disaster in terms of lives lost and the degree of damage and the history of the state?
It wasn't number one. And they also bulldozed the building 2 days after the fire. It happened Saturday night at 9 o'clock. By 3 o'clock on Monday morning, 3/4 of the building was bulldozed down the hill.
Let's see if we can fix
that. Wow. Yeah, Tom, I know you got to lay out all the evidence. Go ahead. I know we're getting ahead of the story. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. Table tag. What room is this, Dave? It's a garden room?
This is a garden room held up to, there were six different rooms in this location. It held up to 950 people. And this was remodeled in 1975.
Nice bar.
This was owned by the mob in the 1950s. This is the bar in 1950s. I got the colored photo from Sam Schrader's wife, was the main kingpin guy for the Cleveland Four in Northern Kentucky. This was the bar in 1950s.
Okay.
Did they have a name for it? Was it the horseshoe bar or anything? It looks like it's more or less the shape of a horseshoe.
Well, they just call it the main bar is what they call it.
Okay.
But this is a black and white photo of the main bar owned by the Cleveland Four and Sam Schrader in the 1950s.
And a couple of martinis in the foreground.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that beautiful? I have the colored photo of that.
Go, Tom.
This national.
Let's say the interior because he was there.
Yeah, Dave.
Yes, this is in the main dining room called the Frontenac Room. It's very beautiful. They had nice, beautiful paintings around the facility, leather chairs. They had the tall back chairs. I have in my collection, I have four of these chairs in my collection at my home. They were spared that night of the fire. They were in a hallway and were saved.
Let's go to the next slide, Cats 13. Yeah. Tell us about this, Dave.
This is the spiral staircase, Jim. As you can see, you got the chandelier. Directly underneath the chandelier is a door frame. That's the door frame of the zebra room that got kicked in. That door frame, two doors only went inward. A bus boy named Buddy Bethel came down the spiral staircase that night. I'm screaming at him not to do it. I knew what he was going to do. He kicked both doors in.
And let all the air, the oxygen in, so the flames just exploded.
It exploded like a freight train. It went up that spiral staircase. We could not get the door shut. It sucked him into the room. We finally got him pulled back out of the room, which he has survived today. And those doors, we could not reach in. It was so hot. And it was trying to draw us in the room. It was so hot that you could not reach in and grab the doors to pull them shut again.
All the heat going up was creating a vacuum-like effect of suction and pulling people in through the door.
That's correct. And
he just didn't know any better.
Right. He was just a young 16-year-old busboy. I was 18 that night, and he just didn't know better. As you could see, this spiral staircase where all the foliage and all this stuff is, it also had a little wishing well. You threw pennies and stuff like that in. That's where the investigator said they thought the fire started.
Out here?
Yes.
How ridiculous can you get?
Well,
the fire's going to start in a wishing well?
Right. And, behind the walls, underneath the spiral staircase is where they said it started. And that is absolutely impossible. Because once the doors got kicked in, you can see exactly where the flames are coming from. And we did not mention here in this area, I witnessed myself at 11, between 11 and 1 o'clock that day inside the zebra room. I saw two gentlemen working in the ceiling the day of the fire. There was two chandeliers dead down the middle of it. One guy was holding the ladder for another guy working above the ceiling tile above the chandeliers. And repeatedly, for an hour and a half time, I kept coming back because we had a banquet coming in there that day. And John Hall wedding reception was going to be there that day at 2 o'clock. I had to set up the room and they were getting agitated with me. So the third time I finally asked him, you know, what are you guys doing here anyway? They said they're working on the air conditioning system, and they were never working on the air conditioning system. They were working up on top of
They were planting the igniter to initiate the fire on probably on a timer.
Right. And, but the timing device, we'll get to this in a little bit, was directly underneath the zebra room in a filter washing system. And we have the specialist as well as the guy that installed it and did the work on it. He's 80 years old now that will tell us exactly what happened. We know.
Wow.
You want to go to the next one, Tommy?
Sure.
Yeah.
Jim, this is a brochure of events that goes on that month or that year of the club. You can see the main bar. You can see the dining room. You can see the spiral staircase. And also, you can go to a show and have a meal for $12.95 in 1975 and see John Davidson. And it was a great entertainment. Just, like I said, it was called the Showplace of the Nation on the East Coast.
And that included appetizer and dessert.
Yeah. Nowhere in the country did they get that at that time. You want to go to the next one, Tom?
This really was a spectacular case, wasn't it?
Yeah. This room is considered, they call it the Viennese room. This held up to 400 people. It broke down to three separate banquet rooms. As you can see in the middle of the room on the left-hand side is a head table, and it's set up for a wedding party for that night. Very beautiful room. That was called the Viennese room. Back in the days of the they considered this area right here, this is where the mob had most of their gambling going on in this room.
Did a lot of members of the wedding party lose their lives?
No one in the wedding party died. There was only 27 people in that room that night. They had left that room at 8:35.
And the fire began at?
We recognized it at 9:05. That was the first observation of the fire by smoke.
Burning. It was already burning, but it hadn't been detected, and they had already evacuated the premises.
They were already out and done. Yes, they were on their way. They were leaving that night. Yes, they were finished.
Fortunately for them.
Well, what's very strange about it is, of the 27 people, Miss America was in there that night. Her father, they're from Elyria, Ohio. There was a gentleman, his wedding party, his name is John Hall. He's from Cincinnati, Ohio. I spoke to him a couple years ago, and he was never interviewed by the Kentucky State Police in this fire. And he said, Dave, he goes, I was an electrical inspector in the Navy. He goes, I heard an explosion go off underneath the Zebra Room. My wife and I were holding each other. Now, this is a small room, held 30 people. That was it. And he goes, I told someone that a breaker bus just exploded in the basement of this room. And he goes, you can hear things grinding throughout the night. And that was a washer system. And they set the fire to happen with the filter washing system. But you can hear it. He said you can hear it throughout the night for a couple hour period that there were some problems going on. He didn't know what it was, but he certainly knew that there was a breaker box exploded in the basement. And no one ever interviewed him.
Shouldn't the club have been responsive to this information, or wasn't it brought to the attention of the right people? I mean, you'd think if he notices that something ought to have happened immediately to investigate and determine the source of the sound.
He never said
a lot of that going on. Yeah.
He told me he never told nobody. I mean, you have to understand, you got people with 2,600 in that room, in the facility, just marching around all over the place. And he just never thought any more about it after he heard it. He said, Dave, I mean, he said, I don't know if he said something to the waitress, but Shirley Baker wouldn't have known what to do. You know what I'm saying? As an employee, 21-year-old, she was a 20-year-old waitress. Wayne Dammert was in there that night, which is a banquet captain at 8:30 that night. He was there to cut the cake, the wedding cake. He was there to present the bill. Now, this gentleman's in full tuxedo. He's got a bow tie on. And he says in his book, his own book, Wayne, he's now 80 years old, says, Dave, that room was not hot. He goes, it was not unusual. It was normal feeling there. And he was there at 8:30 and left out at 8:35 after he got paid. And everyone exited that room at 8:35. And there was nothing unusual in the room, no smoke, nothing abnormal. He said it was a normal room for him. And it wasn't hot enough for him, and he would have noticed it.
Wow. Tom, you want to advance to the...
Well, yeah, the next slide there is the actual copy of the actual letter that Ray Munch, the volunteer fire chief of Southgate, wrote to the NFPA after that 1970 fire. One of the interesting things, like I said, this is a club that held close to 3,000 people, and the closest fire department is a volunteer unit. And Mr. Mutch, who I have a lot of respect for, had a full-time job. He was a beer salesman, drove a beer truck. And he still had to be responsible for a club of this size. On the second page, the next one lists the reasons, like we talked about, getting a call 15 minutes before the fire, finding the gas cans. And,
these are the prima facie reasons for believing it was arson, which made no impression on the Kentucky State Police.
Well, Jim,
right now, the Kentucky State Police would not share information with him. He took him till March after that fire in June to respond because he kept waiting for information from the Kentucky State Police that never came. They said, if you want it, you'll have to drive down here.
What distance would that? You mean to Frankfurt?
Frankfurt.
From
to take a couple hours.
From Newport to Frankfurt.
One way. Yeah.
What would that be?
We can prove there's a
half 45 minutes, maybe.
We've been to Frankfurt. I'm thinking
2.5 hours.
Yeah, half an hour to 45 minutes. That'd be my guess. Mm-hmm. This is, the evidence here is just stunning. I mean, a 15-minute advance warning, you know, the hole, the gallon cans. I mean, my God. The doors.
Yeah, I just put them in. We have pictures of the gas cans as well.
This is simply ridiculous, Tom. This is so blatant. I mean, you're talking about massive corruption in the Kentucky State Police. It's not just that it's obvious it was arson and that it was a mob deal, but that the Kentucky State Police were covering it up. Of course, they're not interested in reopening the case.
And as you'll see in the next investigation for 1977, and much better.
Jim, I'd like to say something, if you don't mind.
Please.
A friend of ours, a part of this organization that we have, is a 37-year fire investigator for the Kentucky State Police. He was a fire marshal, two stints in 37 years. He said it's legal arson in the state of Kentucky. He said it's absolutely tragedy. What we've showed him in the last 10 years or 9 years, and he's no longer in the fire division either. He retired 4 years ago. But he said basically it's legal to burn buildings down in Kentucky. Because what happens is Kentucky State Police does all the fire investigations for the state of Kentucky. I don't know if you know that. The fire marshal's office does not. The arson is checked by the Kentucky State Police.
So they're in collusion with the mob. And these are mostly insurance scams, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And others forms of extortion. I mean, here they weren't getting the kickback or getting control. They wanted to wrest control, so they burned it down as a form of punishment. I mean, this is horrendous. I mean, especially when you had, 169 innocent souls that were taken out by this malicious act?
Absolutely.
And document.
And the state of Kentucky, the fine governor in Kentucky was indicted on mob-related incidents in the state of Kentucky. And that's Governor Carroll. He's 85 years old and still governor, is still in the state Senate in Kentucky.
Jim, there was a period in Kentucky of 35 years where every single governor was either indicted or investigated for federal violations.
Yeah, I'm trying to recall who was governor when I was there. I was in Kentucky at UK from 70 to 77.
Maybe Happy Chandler?
Yeah, no. Happy Chandler. He was there.
Then Julian Carroll.
Happy and Julian Carroll. Yeah, that sounds right.
But Julian Carroll was in charge of the fire itself. He came there that night and took over the fire of the Kentucky State Police.
Wow.
NFPA sent a guy named Richard Best on Monday morning. He goes to John Conover and also Brandenburg and asks him, stop bulldozing this building because I can't do a proper investigation of this fire if you keep tearing up the evidence. His exact to him was,
they couldn't get the bulldozers in there fast enough, could they?
Well, we'll show you his pictures here in just a couple minutes.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it, Tom. I know you got a third page of this document. Next slide.
That's just the last page of the document signed by Mr. Munch, and then there's a picture coming up next.
But, Tom, you know, this is a textbook case of arson. I mean, it couldn't be more blatant. Yeah. It couldn't be more obvious. You got more evidence. I mean, most honest law enforcement officers would dream of having this much evidence because it's open and shut.
Well, you haven't seen anything yet, Jim.
Okay.
This room here is a showroom. This is called the cabaret room. This is where the show was. It held 1,000 people. That night was 825 people in that room. There was three separate banquet areas going off in there that night, so it had a lesser amount of people that would be in there. It couldn't put any more.
Who was performing that night?
John Davison.
He's a singer-songwriter.
Yes, he was. All the women loved him. So, I mean, he really copywrote a lot of different songs from other people.
He was a big draw.
Yes, he was. He was huge. I had the contract that he played that week. It was $70,000 in 1977.
For a week at the club?
Yes, $70,000. Yes. And he did. He brought a lot of, you know, he was good. He done two shows nightly on the weekend and one through the week.
So roughly $10,000 a day.
Yep.
Tom, the next shot is going to be rather stunning, right? It's quite a mess.
Yeah. Well, that's the day after the fire.
This is black about 7 o'clock.
They're putting out some areas of it. And that's what the property looked like on Sunday that week. Then the next picture shows you what it looked like 5 days later.
Wow.
There's nothing left. There's a kitchen on the right side and a very small portion of the front of the building. And what is the first rule of evidence? You got to protect it.
Yeah, you got to maintain it intact. This is what Rudy Giuliani did on 9/11. He got 115 dump trucks and they started hauling away the debris from the World Trade Center. Even though high-ranking fire officials and others were insisting it had to be inspected to determine the cause of what had taken place.
Right. No, it's unprecedented. I've never seen anything, you know, like it myself, where
this belongs in the police. This is a classic case that belongs in every legal and crime scene investigator's textbook. So that they understand a classic case, cut and dry, mob hit, cover up, collusion with the state police, even the governor. I mean, it's unbelievable. This is just so blatant. It's so blatant. I'm just blown away.
Imagine this, and that on May 29th, the day after the fire, that afternoon, Kentucky State Police showed up at the home of Richard Schilling Jr. They told him point blank right then, arson's out. We start bulldozing tomorrow.
Arson's out.
The day after the fire.
That's just amazing.
Yeah. But then the next picture, it's interesting how this played out in the media the following week. Here you've got, let's see, this is 23. You got the Inquirer, where they clearly say in the first column in both all three paragraphs, it talks about there's definitely an explosion in the basement. They're sure about this, and you know they're not questioning at all. Julian Carroll even says in the next column that he believes it spread through the air conditioning system. Now here he's getting some good information. Now the next slide is from the Cincinnati Post. That's the afternoon paper the same day where it talks about we moved up good that. All of a sudden now, all information is being funneled to Carroll.
What in the world would the governor have to do with an investigation of a scene of a fire? I mean, that's bizarre.
Well, he took over the whole site.
Imagine this, okay? He's got with him on the site the commissioner of police, a guy by the name of Ken Brandenburg. He had taken the job 6 months earlier. When he took it, he was 35 years old. Fresh off the campus of Transylvania University, where he was an administrator, had no police experience.
And this guy was put in charge of the Kentucky State Police?
Yes.
You got it. Because here's what happens in Kentucky, and it's still this way. That's a political position. So is the fire marshal, insurance. Back then, Carroll made up to close to 2,000 appointments, and they all go to cronies. And nobody's there to hold them accountable because they're all beholden to him.
Well, I'm telling you, this is very disillusioning, you know.
Well, now here, wait till you see this one. Now, both the last two articles talked about the fire in the basement. We know from talking to Rodney Rady, the former fire marshal, that the fire marshals back then were the arson investigators. They were told on Tuesday when they were coming up after the Monday holiday, turn around, we don't need you. Don't come here at all. And we know, too, that they weren't done extinguishing the fire in the basement till Tuesday. But amazing, next slide, please. In this article, it clearly states that they ruled out the basement. The search of the basement showed the area was untouched by flames. A complete flip-flop from what they told us the 2 days before.
And if you don't mind me adding to this, there was only one fire investigator, arson, in Kentucky there on site the whole time. His name was Clell Upton, and we found him a couple of years ago. And he told us that he went through the air handling system and also all the ductwork in the basement, and he told the governor that the fire started in the air handling system in the basement, or the filter washing system. And the governor told him to shut his mouth that he was getting ready to retire in a couple of years, and he didn't want to get in the middle. He did not want to get in the middle of this fire. Now, we have that on documentation as well as on an hour and a half testimony I took from him in 2013.
Now, Dave, what's the relationship between the origin of the fire and those guys who were doing the work in the room that you were causing you to have a problem getting into the room?
If you don't mind, let's wait till we get to those pictures, because I think it'd be a lot easier to understand and comprehend.
You got it.
Thank you. All right, go ahead, Chance.
This is the Jim. This is a showroom, considered a cabaret room. As you can see, the curtain there opens up in the middle and folds back. It divides two ways back. You know, just right down the center and back to the left. It's a beautiful room.
This building, at one time or another, you had people like Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, Jerry Lewis, some of the kings of the industry play there.
It was huge.
Did Sinatra ever play there?
No, he did not. No.
Dean Martin did.
Dean Martin, yeah.
You got to understand.
Sammy Davis, maybe?
Yes, he was there. You got to understand, the Rat Pack owned Beverly Hills with the mob from 1936 to 61. They were part of the Rat Pack, all those guys.
To 61. And, of course, this particular fire was in 77.
Right. It sat dormant for 9 years.
But this is when the mob was trying to regain control.
In the 70s, yes.
Right.
You got to understand.
Why did they ever relinquish control in 61?
What happened is Robert Kennedy came in and shut Newport down. They called it the Sin City of Newport.
Yes. Bobby and Jack, sure. Cracking down on organized crime.
Yep, in 1961, they came into Newport and shut down everything.
So they probably forced the mob to relinquish their ownership.
Right, right. And in 1951, they brought in Mo DeLeese, which was he was the first guy from the Cleveland Four to go to Vegas and open up the Sands Hotel in 1947. And they brought him in to testify in federal court, and he's laughing on the witness stand at everybody in the courtroom. And the judge asked him, well, what are you laughing about in here, Mr. DeLeese? He says, I'm laughing because you're trying to tell me I have illegal gambling going on in my clubs called the Lookout House, the Beverly Hills, and every one of the governors and every one of the state senators and all the police and everyone, and they're playing in my clubs. And now you're going to tell me I'm running an illegal gambling casino.
That was supposed to be a disproof? The fact that the governors and the state senators were there, I mean, what it implied was, of course, they were corrupt, too.
Right. He did not get detained. He didn't go to jail. Nothing happened to Mo DeLeese, and he was the main guy that ran the Cleveland Four, out of Vegas.
At one time, Jim, I met a man with Dave down in Newport that claimed he used to drive a limo for the governors. And he would say he'd come up here once a month and pick up bag money, take it back down to state capitol.
Was this for Carroll?
Well, sir.
Which governor was it at the time?
He basically said all of them.
All of them?
Yeah.
So it was Happy Chandler and Carroll and what, their predecessors as well, huh?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's why they're all corrupt.
And you might need to know too, Jim, very well known by the mayor of Newport, and his name is T. TV Peluso, Johnny TV Peluso, told Tommy and I as well before he died about 5 years ago that the Kentucky State Police could not run a, they could not come in and raid a gambling casino in Newport, Kentucky without him knowing a day prior. They were not allowed in his city without the state police letting them know ahead of time. It was amazing.
They had to get permission or ask to be in.
And you could make sure people who would be embarrassed by being arrested were not there.
Right. Or you just turn the tables over and make something else, you know, a banquet hall out of it.
Right. To camouflage what's actually going on.
Right. Well, Jimmy Brink used to own the Lookout House, which is in the Kenton County area, and Beverly Hills was in Southgate. And if you look through the history of it, all the gambling casinos, the two largest ones were Jimmy Brink's Lookout House and the Beverly Hills Supper Club owned by Mo DeLeese and the Cleveland Four. When they knew the house was going to be raided that day, they would send their clients over to either one of the other places. They knew ahead of time. No one ever got raided. Neither one of those clubs ever got raided that I know of.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. What's the next slide there, Tom? 27?
That's the actual Zebra Room. Go ahead, Dave.
This is the Zebra Room, the cake that night around 8:30 before it was cut. That was the only photo left of that room that night that I can find in the history of colored photos to the Beverly Hills Supper Club.
Was the had the fire taken place yet, or this is earlier in the evening?
That was at 8:25. Right. The picture was taken 8:25 that night. The fire was the cake was cut at 8:30. Everyone's out by 8:35.
The fire was already burning.
What's that?
The fire was already burning, right?
Yeah, through an air handling system and directly underneath this room and through the AC and all the ductwork, yes.
Tom, we got a diagram here on the next page.
Yeah. That's how it was set up that night.
You can see the double doors as you go inward there and the T-shape.
From the spiral staircase, yep.
Yeah, you walked in and there was a T-shape. The far wall straight behind the head table where it's got the table there, that far wall right there used to have a fake fireplace there. It was all set up in mirrors and black frame mirrors. It was a beautiful room.
Very you don't nice. Think the owners had any idea this was going to happen, did they?
I think that the father might have had an idea because they're putting pressure on him to sell. But you have to understand, this place held 2,600 people, and when they came in and shook him down a month prior to that, he said it wasn't for sale. He said, this is a cash cow. He goes, when I get back from my surgery, he had a hernia surgery first week of May. He goes, I'm going to start bulldozing the lake and excavating the land. I'm going to build a 250-room suite hotel, 5,000-seat convention center, and retail shops up on this site. And the bulldozer, that's what the problem was. The bulldozer was already on site the night of the fire because shellings were getting ready to start excavating work the following week.
So the mob could not have taken that very kindly because they're seeing money just disappearing from what they wanted in their own pockets, not in his.
Right. And right. Tommy found out in the part of their lease option to buy, three things they weren't allowed to do was to build retail shops, a convention center, or a hotel. That was part of the lease agreement. They were not allowed to do it.
So it had a time component on it. It was from 3 years from the time that the mortgage for this piece of property was bought in 1974. Roughly about 3 years later is when this fire happens. The mob really had him pretty well landlocked except for this one piece of ground that he bought and he wasn't allowed to do anything with for 3 years. And it's my belief that what they wanted to do was develop the property themselves. So I think that's a big part
sure,
of the
Sure, of course. Yeah,
argument.
Absolutely. Now, when it's making so much money, why hadn't he paid off the mortgage?
I don't know. I was
maybe it was a constraint in the mortgage that you couldn't pay it off in advance.
Yeah. And he should have been able to pay it off quickly and easily. And it may have even been paid off, but it was never recorded as such because I did search those documents myself. The other thing I'd like to add to this, if you see that little where it says curtain, that's a small area between the Zebra Room and the front bar. And the receptionist, Eileen Druckmann, sat back there, and she took reservations for the day. She's the first person that noticed anything having to do with a fire. When she opened the little door to try to get some punch. She saw smoke, and that's how things got started. But we'll get into her more later. I want people to understand where she was.
Was she able to set off a fire alarm? Was there any sprinkler system, anything like that in the building?
No, there was not.
But here's the thing, Jim. Some people got very agitated about that and said, well, the state should have made them have it. One expert named was Brannigan, a very well-distinguished and known man who worked on fire codes for years, said it could have been worse with sprinklers because, as you'll find out, the fire was actually between the ceiling and the roof. And it was building up of heat, building up of smoke. A lot of people never saw flames at all. He says that if the sprinkler system would have been set off, it would have come down as steam and very hot water and could have injured more people.
Hmm. Steam burns.
Valid point. Yeah.
Well, let's look at the next slide before we have to take our break.
This is about 9:05 that evening, about 5 minutes after the when it's recognized. Maybe it's 9:10 because you see the first fire responder right there in front of you.
Well, that's the first fireman right there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you have to understand, too.
There's not a whole lot he's going to be able to do.
Well, you got to understand, Jim, when Southgate got up there with the first truck, they had the wrong hookup of hose. The adapter wasn't big enough. They had to go back down and Southgate
down
get another hookup.
Down the narrow winding road and traffic coming up and everyone excited, and that's terrible.
It is. Okay. What happened? It happens. We asked them when they first came up to the site, let's take this hose into the front of the Zebra Room. They refused. They took their first truck and went to the back of the building because they started losing lives. They recognized that people were dying from smoke inhalation, and we were dragging bodies out of there, two and three at a time. But they refused to take a water hose or a fire hose straight into that main entranceway so we can put the fire. We were going to do it for them. They wouldn't allow us to do it. They wouldn't let the owner and the management take it into the main area.
Are you implying that even the fire responders were complicit in the crime?
No, I don't think so. I think that they were very, very young in what they knew. They had no knowledge of a facility as large as that was. They were volunteer, and I think they were scared to death. No, they couldn't make the right decisions. You've got to understand, 2,600 people in the facility. The place looked like, it really truly looked, when it was engulfed in flames, you couldn't throw water on to put it out if you wanted to. If they would have had fire trucks at each corner of that building putting fire out at 9:10, it wouldn't have done any good for it. It was already gone. It was just burning too long. 2 hours of hot fire, the way it was. It was incredible.
You guys are on to something very, very big here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest, Tom McConaughey and David Brock, talking about the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire in 1977 in Kentucky. We'll be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host, continuing my conversation with Tom McConaughey and David Brock about the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire in Kentucky in May of 1977. You guys are doing a great job of exposing this, and I'm really concerned about your well-being. Your book came out 4 years ago. Is that correct, Tom?
Right.
And it's been available. Has it been available on Amazon.com or anywhere else, or only by kind of?
It has been available at Amazon.com. We had it in some Costco's, Chobet bookstores. Currently, it's out of print. We separated from our publisher this year, and we're making other arrangements to get it reprinted because there's still a demand. People out there looking for it.
Who was your publisher?
Saratoga Press down in Bellevue, Kentucky.
Well, if they're in Kentucky, they might have been under pressure not to publish more copies of your book.
I don't know if that was a problem. I think our biggest issue was, you know, we sold out. We didn't make any money.
How big was your first print?
Roughly somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000, and that doesn't include the digital version sold on Amazon. And that's hardback.
You sold roughly 4,000 to 5,000, and you got no royalties back from it.
That's right.
That doesn't sound right. Maybe your publisher is run by the mob too. But you know, then they wouldn't have let you publish it at all, I would think. I mean, this is a real expose. I've had a lot of books that never sold 4,000 or 5,000 copies. I mean, that's a very respectable run already.
It's got a great following. The people that read it, I think we had 4.5 stars running on Amazon as far as
very good
content. Yeah.
Very good.
I'm very proud of the content.
Well, Jim, people that read the book can't put it down. That's what I hear from them. They give me a call after they buy it, and they said, I'm madder than hell at you. Why are you mad at me for? Because I went home last night. I couldn't stop reading the book. I had to finish it.
You know, Amazon has a subsidiary called CreateSpace that probably would be a good outlet for your book. They could publish your book for you. I recommend you check it out.
Thank you. We'll look into that.
Let's look at what you got here, an FBI memorandum, if we take a check at this slide number 30.
Right. Now, I did a Freedom of Information Act with the FBI with anything to do with Sam Schrader, Dick Schilling, the Cleveland Four, and Beverly Hills. And we got basically three things. Two letters we're going to show you here, and a third with a detailed list of the FBI's involvement in trying to identify bodies. This first one here is the one we were talking about where the agents on the plane with some type of mob associate from RJ, Kentucky, and you can see the redacting that was done. We tried to pull some strings to try to get some answers on it, and we haven't been successful as of yet. That's the first page, and the next page is the follow-up. We only have the first page here. The next page is kind of interesting because it shows that one of the things that the state police recovered was a roulette wheel that they valued at $22,000. For whatever reason, they got the head of the FBI to write a letter requesting that they get custody of that wheel, which they did, which they took to Quantico for training purposes.
What?
Yeah.
The FBI wanted the roulette wheel? That had to be recycled back to the mob, Tom. There's no way around it. The FBI has no business. The FBI has no business with a roulette wheel in Quantico. That's just ridiculous.
Well,
that's what it says.
Well, they stole all the equipment that was in the basement directly. It was a safe in the basement. They had like five roulette wheels. And we're finding that now they're starting to sell these. The state police, retired state police, are starting to sell roulette wheels to different people in the state of Kentucky for 10.
Oh, is that, so it was the state police who took it all?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought it was the FBI.
The FBI found out that the state had it, and they lobbied to get it. And eventually they wound up.
Did state police use the FBI to lobby to get, or they lobbied the FBI to get possession of this equipment?
What happened is, like I said, as Dave said, the state police took roughly five roulette wheels from the basement without the permission of the owners.
That's just grand theft, Tom.
Well, they also took money from lockers, we hear, and took other things. But that's just the way they operate. The laws don't apply to them. And once the state of Kentucky, these individual officers had these roulette wheels, FBI found out about one of them anyway, and said, hey, we really, really want to have that. And they had to get the state police sign off on it and the Shilling somehow. So there was some kind of pressure going on. Whatever reason, they wanted it bad.
Why in the world would they want a roulette wheel?
They took everything out of the basement, Jim.
Yeah,
they stole
it all. I'm talking, you're saying the FBI wanted a roulette wheel?
Yeah, here's what it says word for word on this thing. It says, these roulette wheels were, handcrafted in wood and were made over 20 years ago. The newer roulette wheels are now made of plastic and sell for over $22,000.
Well, that's saying these roulette wheels are worth in excess of $50,000 or more. I mean, that's what they're saying there. But that doesn't sound like a rationale for why the FBI would want one. Are they going to put it on display in a FBI Hall of Crime? Or
unless they could have been looking at what the Shillings had there, because it was an older model of it, and they were just trying to, when they were raiding these places around the world, they probably figured out what the Shillings had versus somebody else.
This is true of so many products. They were higher quality in the old days than they are today, so you can see why the mob or whatever might want to get a hold of them just because they're so valuable.
Right.
Yeah. I'd love to know where it is now.
I know where one's at.
You care to say, Dave, or prefer not?
No, I'll tell you. A guy named David Horn's house. He's a fireman in Covenant, Kentucky. Lives in Independence. He's got one. He bought one for $1,500 from a state policeman.
Wow. So it's like the state police were looting the scene of the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire.
Yes, they were. Yes.
Wow. Okay, let's go to 33, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Here's the first picture we're going to show you. Remember that article that said there was no visible flame damage down in the basement?
Yeah.
Here's a picture. In the corner there, in the center of that V on the right, is a furnace filter washer unit. It's got a hole that is about the size of a watermelon in the front of it. Inside, we'll get the picture that's closer. You'll be able to see the fire damage inside and evidence. To the left of that.
To claim there was no fire here is simply absurd.
Well,
yeah, it's ridiculous. And this is a picture that came with a set that it took us 2 years to win the Kentucky State Police, went all the way to the Attorney General, who made them give us the pictures. They've been hiding it the whole time. They never were part of any court proceedings. That's the way they operate.
Jim, do you see the V pattern here? Do you see the V pattern?
Well, tell me, Dave, what exactly I'm looking at.
You see the red lines there, and you got a V.
Yeah, I see the red line, sure.
Okay. And on the left side there, you see the white, and then you see the brown in the middle?
Yeah.
Or the black, the white is 2,000 degrees, anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 degrees. Where the charcoal brown is, that's 1,500 to less. I didn't know that until a specialist told me. So not only that there was fire in the basement, you can see that it's quite hot in this area that burned for over 2 hours.
And that cannot have been without accelerants. I mean, that had to have.
Correct.
We'll show you how it happened.
No. Go for it.
One of the reasons that happened with that white burn on the left wall is there was a pull box that was supposed to have three fuses in it. In the court papers, it clearly shows the men who work on the air conditioning system removed two of them and replaced them with copper pipes.
Replaced them with copper pipes?
Right.
So it would not break. When it got too hot, the system itself would not break. It ran 100%. It would not do like you have a breaker on your.
This was a cleverly designed fire to conceal that it was burning for a long time by making these special arrangements and changes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And if you notice that unit with a hole in it, on the lower left-hand side of it, I want you to notice how it gets pulled away from the wall. Initially, it sat flush against the wall. Now, above there is an air vent that went through the zebra room. And it'll all become, you'll understand that relative soon. The next picture is the close-up picture on the furnace filter washer. And you can see, obviously, there's fire inside there. And like Governor Carroll said early on, said it looked like it spread in the air conditioning system. Well, here's why. Now, again, while we're looking at it, you can see it was initially wired in conduit, hardwired, per the way the manufacturer would have you do it. And we're going to get to what happened since. Now, again, look at the bottom, how far that came out from the wall when that explosion happened. Now, the next picture is the duct across the center of the room. Look how that buckled. Because when that unit pushed away from the wall, it took with so much force, it forced that vent to buckle.
Yeah.
The next, yeah. Then the next picture, two. Again, there's more of the basement that hasn't seen any fire. On to the next. And here's on the other side of the unit, that I-beam. From the force of that HVAC unit being thrown into it, buckled. It was one hell of a blast. That whole unit moved in some parts almost 2 feet.
From the explosion, Jim.
From the explosion.
And it said there was no fire in the basement. Now you got to understand from the governor 3 days later.
Yeah. Here you are looking from the zebra room down into the basement that didn't have fire.
And you saw how hot that got.
Yeah.
That's why it's so pristine and clean, neat and tidy.
Yeah. I don't see any fire there. And the next picture, I think, let's see. This is another area showing damage in the basement. You can see around the duct piece there, centered just a little bit to the left, how it's charred all the way around it, probably because the flames are being shot through it like a rocket after that explosion. Now, one thing to understand, that furnace filter washer unit is hooked up to the furnace filter. It's an electrostatic type unit. And anytime you get those dust particles mixed in a type of explosion, it's just a bad recipe for disaster. And that's what I believe happened there. Then we go back to the unit again on the next picture, 41. And again, you can see how that thing pushed the weight of the unit out from that wall. And again, you can see inside, obviously, there was fire involved inside that unit. Now, I don't know how, I do. One of the reasons they thought they could do this, Jim, was they had actual insurance investigators, other investigations that would come in and say, okay, we want to go see the basement. Oh, no. It's too dangerous. We've been bulldozing up here, and you don't have to worry about the basement. There's no fire down there. None of the investigators got free rein to go wherever they wanted. None got to ask questions of any witnesses. They were given what they wanted them to see, and that's it.
And it was the Kentucky State Police who were managing the scene of the crime.
Yes, with Governor Carroll.
Right.
It's fascinating. The governor would intrude. It's fascinating. The governor would be so intrusive in a fire like this. I mean, that's highly unusual. I expect it's never happened in any other state before.
Not that I've
ever heard. Carroll is a little bit of a control freak. From what I've been able to monitor and learn about him.
Who's the governor of Kentucky now?
Bevins. Governor Bevins.
And he's probably a good old boy, too?
No, I don't think so. I think he's out of the good old boy. He's out. He's not with that network. No.
So he might actually be clean?
He could be a clean one. We don't know that yet. We've got to figure that out here soon.
Yeah, so far.
Wow.
Now, moving on, you know, we mentioned how this unit was hardwired. We go to the next picture, and you can see in the middle on the right side. Oops, that's one too many, Chance. 42. There it is. You see that wire snaking across that furnace filter unit? Why do you have a loose cord like that when the unit's hardwired? It's because those guys, when they came in, they rewired the source of electricity for that unit. I'm going to show you where it went. Now, in the next picture.
So, Dave, you actually were dealing with the arsonists who were preparing to create the conditions for the fire.
Yes, sir. I saw them for about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes. But you have to understand, it goes much deeper than that, too, Jim. We can put them in the location. I saw them Saturday from 11 to 1 o'clock. They were there on Thursday and Friday. I witnessed testimony that have seen these people on Thursday and Friday during the day as well, working in these areas.
Dave, tell me about your phone call when you talked to them, to use that.
Who are you talking about? Oh, I talked to the taller gentleman that I met that day that was hiding in the ductwork and in the ceiling that day. And I called him in his home one day, and Tommy was there with dinner with me. And I said, Al, you need to step forward and tell what you know. He goes, you don't want to know. I said, what do you mean? I do want to know. And, he said, there's things I know I can't tell you. I can't do that. I said, well, you're going to take this to your grave, then is what you're going to do. Then he hung up on me.
Okay. Now, in this picture, we can see that same cord. Go back one, Chance. 43, please. There we go. On this one, you see that cord hanging between the electronic air cleaner and the cooling cord?
Yeah.
That's that same wire as it goes up above the cooling coil to a thermal device that was above there. Then it went to a magnetic relay, and then it came down a concrete pillar. And that's the next picture on 45.
Chance, 45, yeah. That's 44.
Oh, that's it, going up down the pillar. And now the next one, 45.
Yeah.
And that's where it found a home.
So this is what they were working on.
Yeah, yeah. They took a 220-volt coil and hooked it up to two 110 outlets.
To generate an electrical fire as the cause of the event.
Exactly. And that's why you've got that big hole in that unit.
Wow.
You
guys have done your homework. I'm really blown away.
Thank you, sir. But again, and we know it wasn't like that 6 months prior because we have a copy of electrical inspection that said everything was fine. Now, let's see.
And hold on, Tommy.
Yeah.
Hold on. Also, Jim, I want you to understand the lady that was taking reservations, Eileen Druckmann, was there from 9 o'clock in the morning to the night it burned down at 9 o'clock. She was in the cubbyhole and also in the main entranceway. She saw these guys working throughout the whole morning, too, as well. And in her deposition to the state police, they said, did we miss something? She goes, yeah, those damn air conditioner guys. And they go, what are you talking about? And this is on a cassette tape in 1977 when they did her testimony. She goes,
yeah, the current plant.
Yep. She goes, the air conditioner guys were running all over the building. They were downstairs. They were in the bar. They were in the zebra room. Then I was taking a reservation around 2:30 that afternoon. Then all of a sudden, I was on the phone, and she heard an explosion underneath the zebra room. And she goes, oh, my God, I'm going to have to call 911. 10 seconds later, these guys come running up from downstairs, ran right to the zebra room. They were laughing about what they did. That's when they were making the copper leads work in the for the power.
You mean they were still on the scene
when
the fire began?
No, 2:30 in the afternoon.
Okay.
They were still jerry-rigging all the stuff that they need to finish up, and that was the last thing they finished was them turning the power back on to where they put those copper leads. They must have had them in wrong because it caused a big explosion in the basement. So they got it fixed and went back upstairs to make sure there was no problem. And that was in her testimony. Then the state police, they go, well, what was their name? And she goes, ISP, which is three digits for whoever the air conditioning company was, or, and they shut the cassette tape off. They didn't interview her no more. They shut it off when they were taping it.
They weren't going there.
This is like JFK, where the FBI did not investigate the 10 witnesses closest to the limousine. And for others, if they knew important information, they didn't ask them the questions that would elicit it. And that if they got important information out into the record, they simply changed the transcripts. Now, this is very, very bad.
Well, let me tell you, I'm going to take it a step further, too. The gentleman that was the air conditioning company of record was an organization called Technical Services Incorporated, and they were called TSI. And I contacted this gentleman 4 years ago, and he said, yes, we were the gentleman that did the work from January 1st of 1977 until the night of the fire. And I said, well, were you there the week of the fire? He goes, no. The last time we were there was 6 weeks prior to Beverly Hills burning down. I said, would you testify to that? He said, absolutely. So we gave these photos, these exact photos that you're seeing today, to him. And he's a specialist. That's what he does for a living. He's 80 years old. His name is Robert Winston. And he was with his dad on Technical Services Incorporated. And he has went through these with a fine-tooth comb. And he knows exactly how they fired that filtering system up for it. They put the wrong chemical in it. And when it ignited that, it burnt for 2 hours. It got up to 2,000 degrees in that air handling system. And as well
they deliberately put the wrong chemical into it.
Right. And we didn't know it, but here in the last few weeks, he finally came to us and said, Dave, this is how they did it. And he showed exactly where they put the chemical. He showed exactly how it works. And, you know, we have the good to prove what we have done. I mean, we've done a lot of work with this in the last 5 years. And it took me 30 years to find these two guys that I saw the day of the fire. And they owned an air conditioning company in Cincinnati, and they were terminated by the Shillings on January 30th, 1976. And they were the two guys in the ceiling the day of the fire. And I could prove it. We proved it. And
you actually know their names?
Yes, I know their names, yes.
Are they in the book?
They're in the book. You want their names?
Yeah, sure.
The name of the air conditioning company is Rash, Chevelle, and Crawford. They're at 147 East McMicken in Cincinnati, Ohio. The owners at that time was Art Reekers and Halfred Holloway. Halfred Holloway was a 6'2", 200-pound man with sideburns and a mustache. And the other gentleman was balding, real stocky guy. His name was Arthur Reekers. That's who I saw in the ceiling the day of the fire.
These were the guys you saw personally, but it was arranging this to happen.
Yes, sir. It was. It took 30 years.
David, wow.
On June the 15th, 2007, I was emailed to the Quick Topic website, the Beverly Hills Supper Club. A gentleman named, I'll give you his name in a second, but he said, I see your name all over the Huh?
Watkins?
Yeah, his name was Watkins. But he goes, I see your name all over the news about this Beverly Hills Supper Club. He goes, you're on the right track. The people that own the club, own the air conditioning company of record, is who you need to investigate. They're the one that does the dirty deeds. And sure enough, they were the ones hired by the mob to burn this building down.
And we
proved it.
Wow. And you got all this in your book.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And also, Jim, while we got it on Mrs. Druckmann, a lot of people noticed weird things that week and that night. People were saying, well, my eyes were watering all night.
Electrical fire.
Yeah.
Produces ozone,
right out of the air. We have a witness, a waitress, who actually saw the people wiping down the hallway. And we think they were wiping off an accelerant that was put in between the wall spaces, these guys that were in the ceilings. And Mrs. Druckmann, she's dead now, but for years after, she had three fingernails that fell off and never grew back. And she had mucus that was literally would seep out of her ears.
And nose.
They found somebody down in Newport that told him that they thought that a chemical called liquid graphite extender might have been used. And we actually, I found the MSD sheet for that. We took it to the local coroner and asked, could this have caused her symptoms? And he said, absolutely.
Wow.
So we likely used a dimmer switch, and that's when she got it, you know, in her fingernails. And just breathing, it must have done it to her ears.
So which one of you is Sherlock and which one is Watson? You guys are doing a brilliant job on this. I'm very impressed.
Thanks.
Well, let me, Jim, if you don't mind, I want to tell you also, when the state police was interviewing her on the cassette, it's live, they asked, what was strange about that night? And she goes, well, we got a call about 8:30 that night, and the guy called her was a southern accent, like from eastern Kentucky, or down in Barbersville, and he asked, when was the last time Beverly Hills burnt to the ground? And she goes, what do you mean? I have no idea. And he goes, well, tell me. He goes, when was the last time Beverly Hills burnt down? She goes, I have no idea. He goes, well, 1970. And he goes, which show tonight's going to be the busier show, the first show or the second show? And she goes, they're both sold out, so it really doesn't matter. So he hung the phone up with her. But you got to understand, in 1977, there was no trace or any way to find out. Not you could do it now, but there's no way to find out who that person was or called. So he had some idea something was going to happen that night too.
Wow. Should we go to 47, Tom?
Sure.
This is actually from your book then, huh?
Yeah. That's from Tom Zanella's book. He was a local professor that I
okay. University of Cincinnati?
No, he
was at Cincinnati State.
Cincinnati State.
Right.
But he got into it too. How far did he get?
Yeah. Nothing like this.
Pardon?
I think we kind of surprised him too. But
Well, Tommy, do you mind just for a second?
No, go right ahead.
The problem you have is, Jim, the only reason why we're as far as we are right now is, to be honest with you, is the two guys in the ceiling of the fire, the day of the fire. Because even the people that sued, they knew there was maintenance people working in the ceiling the day of the fire. But all these specialists that we talked to that sued, that came in and testified in court, told me, they're not smart enough to do what you think they did. And I said, what are you talking about? Well, we knew there was maintenance people were in there working that day, or a couple of days prior, but they weren't smart enough to do what you think they did. And I said, they're air conditioning specialists. What are you talking about? That's their job. And they did do the dirty deed, these guys.
How ridiculous to say these guys aren't smart enough to do what they obviously did. I mean, obviously they're smart enough to do it. They did it. I mean, this is... A really ridiculous argument.
Well, James Donnelly. James Donnelly is in Atlanta, Georgia. He was part of C back in the 70s. And he was there the two days after the fire. He's the one that said, oh, it started underneath the spiral staircase. And you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, Mr. Donnelly, I have photographic proof to show you where the fire started at. And he goes, I made millions of dollars from my testimony. And don't jeopardize what I do in my life for some kind of BS now 30 years later. I said, no, it's not BS, it's straight back. I said, if I send you the photos to prove where the fire started, would you change your mind or would you at least look at it? Well, once we sued the state of Kentucky, we got our photos. Tommy sent it down to him. Now you won't take our telephone call.
You have sued the state of Kentucky?
Yes, we won in court. We sued the lab tech that took all the photos. There's 2,500 colored slide photos and 2,500 colored photos in his house, in his basement, and they're not in the case file of the state of Kentucky. That's correct.
Wow. How can all that evidence be suppressed? I mean, the whole point of taking the photographs is to have them in the public record as evidence.
They don't even have them in the courts. They didn't even have these photos in court. We had to befriend this guy that has these at his house and get about 70 of them, and then he realized who we were. And he wouldn't deal with us no more. Kentucky State Police, because he was retired, he was worried about losing his pension. He thought he was going to get in trouble.
Well, did he get in trouble?
Uh, he got reprimanded by the federal judge and told him what an interesting case we have here due to the fact.
Go ahead.
We have an interesting case here. He goes, you got 90 days to get these photos of these folks. I'm going to hold you in contempt of court. He goes, I want to see really what happens with these. Out of over 3,000 photos that they had, they only turned in 367 of them. Only the 367 they wanted.
Is the judge aware that they withheld what they didn't adhere to his order?
No, we did not go. Our Dinsmore and Scholl did. They did an open records request and won in court. They did what we asked them to do. They did it pro bono with no charge. They worked on it for 3 years, and that was as far as they were going to go with it.
Jim, if I may, yeah, I told you about Ken Brandenburg, the chief executive for the Kentucky State Police with no experience. And it's not the only time that during his tenure, they suppressed photos. It happens that in 1979, there was a Kentucky State trooper who made a routine pullover. A guy by the name of Gray waited till he got to the window and shot him point blank and took off. Well,
the driver of the limousine shot the trooper.
Right. It wasn't a limousine, it was just a car. And he took off and went to Illinois. The police found out about it because they went in and roughed up his family at their home. So two Kentucky State troopers went with two Illinois troopers to the hotel room, went in like gangbusters, shot the man 5 times, at which point they all testified was self-defense. Well, the reason Brandenburg lost his job in 79 was the attorney general then found out he removed all the pictures showing the man was only shot in the back.
Shot 5 times in the back?
Yeah, self-defense. Kentucky State Police.
Wow. We've had other cases like that here around America, haven't we? That's really terrible.
Yeah.
Tom, you better proceed. Given that we're in the last leg of our conversation.
Go ahead. That's 48. And that just goes on. This goes up to 1972. The next one goes up to the fire. Obviously, there's multiple fires at these clubs going on through the 70s. And it's also really the same time that, the movie Casino is set as well as Goodfellas. That's the way the mob was going. Now, this is something I found out was signs of arson. They're not terribly difficult to understand. They're pretty obvious. If you look at witness observation, we have a captain from Cincinnati who was in that area at the time and said the way the flames went down that hallway where we believe the accelerant was, it was way too fast for not to be accelerated. A low pressure wave, an explosion, air injury to the hands, face, legs, rolling flames. Of the first 11, 9 were present at Beverly Hills. And we didn't even go there. And one of the most glaring ones that they ignored, too, is it was a holiday weekend.
The ones you checked are the 9
right.
out of 11. Yeah.
That's right. So now the next one is from the Kentucky State Police roll call, number 50. And it shows they had like 6 or 7 arson specialists there. They sent 6 to the hotel to do interviews and left 1 on the site. And this is after they told the fire marshals, they weren't needed. So one man's supposed to do the investigation on a 54,000 square foot building.
And that brought about, 169 deaths?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's absurd. That's absurd. Yeah. This is a major crime.
It's documented here. This is Kentucky State Police. I don't know what else to say.
This is sickening. This is absolutely sickening.
Oh, you're going to hate the next one. 51.
I know. It struck me when I was setting it up. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Arson is eliminated.
Yes. Now, here's the thing. They did take some things to their labs to test. Those tests weren't back till August. But here it is, 5 days after the fire, and they announced publicly arson's out. That criminal itself.
Unbelievable.
52. And again, this explains how Carroll went down from Frankfurt to Southgate that day. Let's see. Talks about, again, what I told you about the history with Ken Brandenburg and it, how he had no experience either. The next one, 53. What we got?
No, I was still reading through that one.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go back to 52.
Is this part of your text? Is this something in your book?
Yeah,
that's all very telling. Yeah, protect the evidence, right?
Let me. I'm going to say something here too. Understand that the Schillings got home about 3 o'clock that morning. Rick and Marge Schilling, in their mailbox when they went out and got the mail, came in. There was a letter with no postmark on it at all, and she opened it up, and someone had cut out letters and pasted it on this letter saying, you continue to build, we'll continue to burn. And they left that in the Schillings mailbox that night. I proved
in other words, if he went ahead with his plan to build a hotel and all that,
right,
that it was going to happen again and again and again.
Well, they said, we burned you once.
Nothing suspicious there, Dave.
No, they said, we burned you once, we'll burn you again. You continue to build, we'll continue to burn. That was left in their mailbox that night.
Nasty.
They made it clear. They made it very clear.
But I mean, how could anyone have any doubt? I mean, another obvious indication, I mean, sufficient proof right there that it was arson. I mean, you know, this isn't rocket science. This is so blatant. This is so obvious. It's simply stunning. But you've been able to weave all the different disparate pieces together and identify the culprits. That's amazing.
It was a lot of work.
I can appreciate it.
The last one, we jumped over 53 real quick. We didn't get a chance to say anything, so we can real quick. This is an article by, obviously, Mr. Coughlin from the Inquirer. Stan Chesley made his name out of this lawsuit after the fire. His contention was it was aluminum wiring. Unfortunately, in fact, he failed to really prove there was ever aluminum wiring in that part of the building. He actually had lost the case first because he couldn't prove it existed, and then won it because the judge changed what he had to prove. He just said, if you think it could have been involved, you can find for the plaintiffs. I think
That's ridiculous.
It took Chesley. Like I said, he was there the night of the fire in jeans and a T-shirt at the bottom of the hill passing out cards. It took him 5 days, literally, to go and get the court thing started. And, again, the only reason he got on the aluminum wiring thing was because at the same time, the Consumer Product Safety Commission was suing all the aluminum manufacturers in the country. So it was an easy way for him to grab onto. And even though he could not prove whose wire was in that building, he was allowed to sue all of them.
That's simply absurd.
Well, and here's another one for you.
I mean, he didn't even have any proof there was aluminum wiring in the building, and he was allowed to sue on the ground that perhaps aluminum wiring was responsible with no proof at all?
Right.
Right, right. And get this, Jim. I know for a fact from reading testimony, the firemen, they were in the cabaret room as late as 11 o'clock that night on their hands and knees under the smoke ceiling, some even without oxygen because they used so much they ran out. Yet Monsanto was sued by Stan Chesley and paid him off handsomely because they had carpet in the building. If the carpet is causing the death, how can these guys walk on their hands and knees through the room?
Yeah, sure.
They, Jim, 33 firms sued in the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. Only one was released from any wrongdoing. Who do you think that was?
Who was released of any wrongdoing?
Yes. It was the ex-air conditioning company that I saw working there the day of the fire.
Dave!
I'm telling you the God's honest truth. It's the truth. 33 firms sued, and only one released from any wrongdoing.
And the one that was released was the one that was most culpable because they were the direct causal agent bringing it about.
Absolutely. Right.
Unbelievable. Yep. Unbelievable.
Okay. Moving on.
Who says this is not a nation of laws?
Yeah. Now, these are some of the experts that testified, working both for the Shillings, working for Sam Chesley. Almost, I'd say 80% of them went back to that toolbox as the cause, because I don't think any of them really got to look into the air handling equipment. But it's obviously that the short from the furnace filter washer unit went right through that pull box, so there's nothing to stop it, no fuses, and then literally sent out a chain of five boxes in the house, including the cabaret room, the crystal rooms, all over wherever these boxes were, that just ignited, shorted out the whole place. It's a big chain reaction. And that's another clue of arson, is when you have fires crapping off in different parts of the building at the same time. And again, these guys are all asked, did you see any aluminum wiring? No. Including the guy who swept out that room. Did you see any? No. Look at this picture. Do you see any here? No, that's plaster. I don't see any. It wasn't there. The man who put it, wired that room with copper, Dave talked to, his name's Jerry Kramer. We know the one. It wasn't there. It's a horrible way to use the court system.
He was Mr. Kramer had all of his documents that he purchased, all the copper wire that he used at Beverly Hills, in the showroom, in the guard rooms, as well as the Zebra room. He saved all of it. When he went on site Monday morning and went to the state police, he said, "Guys, I can help you out and show you where everything is at here, all the exits and everything, where everything was done." And they told him if he didn't shut his mouth and get in the police cruiser and get out of there, they were going to handcuff him from code violations. He goes, "I didn't do anything wrong. Everything I have in here is done by copper wire." He goes, "Well, you put aluminum hi-hats in the Zebra room. That's where the fire started at." He goes, "That's an absolute lie." So on the state police, when they took him out of that site, they said, "If I was you, sir, I would never come back up to here, because they're out after you. Somebody's ended up killing you." So he never went back. He never testified in court or anything. But he knew he put copper wiring in it.
He was the electrician who done the original wiring.
Yeah, he knew what he put in.
Of course he knew he hadn't used aluminum wiring. He'd have records for all of his expenses and everything else, the acquisition of the copper wire and everything else.
And everything that was delivered to Beverly Hills, he had copies of everything, all of his invoices and everything. That's correct.
Ironically, electrician was his second job that he did part-time. He was a full-time fireman.
Wow. So he obviously knew what would be a fire hazard or not, and was not interested in doing work that would be hazardous in any way.
Right.
Amazing.
Tommy, we need to get moving because I want to get to this child that died in there too.
Yeah.
Okay. We're almost there. We got one more in between. And this is going to be okay. Go ahead and go to Keith, Dave.
There was two witnesses in April that saw the two gentlemen speaking with the Shillings and the family at the bar when they were shaking Mr. Shilling down, saying they want to purchase the place back. He said that these guys were not; they were informants only, speaking for the mob, the Cleveland Four. And Mr. Shilling said, "Well, this place isn't for sale. I'm not selling it. It's a cash cow. Why would I get rid of it?" And the guy said, "We'll be your partners then." "No, I'm not interested. We're doing $15 million a year. We're getting ready to build this beautiful convention center and all that." And the guy said, "Well, after that, if we can't have it, maybe you won't have it no more."
He actually said it to him right there on the spot.
Right on the spot. So Dick ran him out. He ran both of these two guys out of the facility.
And there were a couple of witnesses to this exchange.
Yes, two women. They were, one was in the ladies' room. The other one was out there behind the curtain listening to this conversation, because it was unheard of for an employee to use the front bathrooms, because that was for customers. And they knew they were not allowed up there. One was named was Judy Holliday. She was in the ladies' room. And the other one named was Shirley Baker. That was behind the curtain listening to these conversations. Well, after Beverly Hills burnt down that year, Judy Holliday's son came up missing on December 21st, 1977.
Her son came up missing.
5-year-old boy, yes.
In the backyard.
There was a swimming pool in the backyard. It was about 2 feet of water. And It was checked 13 times within 3.5 to 4 months. Shirley Baker at that point was testifying. They were coming to talk to her about what she saw, and someone stopped and came to her house and told her to shut up, that, you know, they knew where her kids were going to school. They knew where her husband was working. If she didn't shut her mouth, they were going to kill everybody in the family. And this was repeated. So, and they said, we got the wrong child, is what they told Shirley. And if you don't know, we know where that child's at, and he's going to come up in water in the spring. He goes, you watch and see. You'll find that baby in the water in the spring. Sure enough, 4 months after that baby came up missing on March the 21st, 1978, the baby comes to the top of the pool, and it's only got 2 feet of water. You got to understand that. It was searched 13 times. The investigator that did the autopsy, his name was Dr. Stein, pulled the baby out of the pool and said, this baby looked like it's been in a deep freeze. There's no deep decomposition of his body or anything. It looked like he was just laid dead out of a freezer and put into the water. There was no water in his lungs.
Which I'm sure is exactly what had happened.
Right.
The autopsy was done by Hamilton County, which now they're a friend of mine. I got the autopsy. They had 4 pathologists look at this autopsy again. The baby did not drown in the pool. There was no water in his lungs. There was nothing in his nasal passages or nothing in his eyelids.
He'd been suffocated, I imagine?
Yes. Yes, he was murdered. And they killed that young man. And the people that did it was the air conditioning company of record.
You mean little boy.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Part and of the it. Other thing to understand too, Jim, is this was a above ground pool, and they had removed the ladder. And he wasn't tall enough to just jump in it himself.
Right. This is one of these backyard things elevated right. On the side. They took out the ladder. I mean, how large? The pool wasn't even that large, I would imagine.
And it was searched 13 times, arm in arm, with state police, county police, Alexander police, and also fire department.
Well, it obviously wasn't there. It wasn't there when they were searching for it.
No, it was not.
I have a friend who was a paramedic who searched the pool and is absolutely certain there's no way he was in there. He was told by one of the detectives, we know who took him. We know where he is. Something's going to happen here. And it all got washed away.
Wow.
And the lead detective on the case.
You want to know why Americans would lose confidence in law enforcement and their government? What more stunning case than this?
Well, and the lead detective in the case, after this happened, said, I'm done being a detective, and went back on the beat on the street. He didn't want any more part.
We have just a few more minutes, so let's continue with this Keith's fear of water. Oh, the kid was afraid of the water too, huh? 57, yeah.
Yes, he was.
And they were so sure it was a kidnapping, the family hired a private investigator for $100,000. To try to find him.
Out of Texas.
What did they realize it was? Well, they did. They knew it was related to her testimony, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
I mean, there was nothing subtle about this.
No, they were very clear to her. They made very clear to her what she had to do.
Let's go to 58. Yep. When the body was found in the pool.
Right.
Who is this guy? Was that the father there, Michael?
Right.
Yes.
He wasn't even involved in any of this. He didn't hear any witness. He wasn't even a witness.
He didn't even know.
When did it emerge? Did it come out in the public press, the connection between her son and the her testifying about what had happened at the club?
No, never made it.
We put together after talking to Shirley Baker, who really kind of is the reason I got started with Dave when I heard that this was involved with it, because she had been threatened, her own kids had been threatened, and that's when Dave came to me and said, hey, let's go down to Kentucky, Frankfort, and look and see what they've got.
And Jim, the trip to Kentucky was a nightmare within itself. The colonel of the Kentucky State Police, after the second day, came in and berated us to the nerve that we had to come in and try to look at a case that's 30 years old, that we had no right to try to have them look at it. And I asked him, did we not do the proper channels and do an open records request in this case? He goes, you got one more day of this, and this is all you're getting. And he basically pushed us out of the building.
Wow. So the cover-up continues to this day.
Oh, yeah.
It's called the Good Old Boy Network in Kentucky. Absolutely. You should know that. In 1970s, you should well aware of know the laws and the enforcement that goes on in this state.
Oh, Dave, I was very naive. I was a young assistant professor. I was, working on publishing, teaching, the whole bit, giving talks in different departments and all that. I mean, I was very active on the campus, but not very aware of what was going on in the state around me. Really naive.
Well, I'm a naive person too, and I believe, and I think you find out with what Tom and I went through in the last 6 years, we've only went after the truth. Everything we have is documented truth. The photos, testimony, the inspectors that we spoke to, hazmat guys in the United States. I mean, Tom's reached out to people in Israel. He's done his homework well. We've done what I was set out to do is to change the findings that is not electrical in nature and possibly aluminum wire. And we finally had the photographic proof to know truly what happened that night.
Tom, in the last few minutes, we have just a couple more slides to cover. Let's go to 59.
Okay. Well, that was the decision by the attorney. Oh, I'm sorry. The next one, we'll go to 60 because that's back to when a private investigator was hired.
Okay.
This is the decision by the attorney general finding for us that the Kentucky State Police did withhold from us the pictures that we were entitled to see and should have been part of the case and actually find them. And they had a supervised some type of plan where they were going to have to redo how they do things. One of the crazy things about when we sued the Kentucky State Police, early on, we sent a Freedom of Information Act request for the specific pictures at that retired policeman's house. He was a lab tech.
Ronnie Frails.
Because he would not supply them to us directly. So we get an email saying that they had two sergeants and a retired major, whatever, look into it and said that there's no truth to it, to our face. So I called Frails the next morning. Do you still have the pictures? Yes, I do. Have you heard from Kentucky State Police? No, I haven't. They lied through the process. They keep changing the reasons for why they had them, how they got to his house. It was unbelievable how sloppy and weak their excuses were.
Tom, we're all but out of time. You want to look at that last slide and say something about
it? Yeah. That's what's up on the hill today overlooking I-471. Traffic going north, like I said, overlooking the highway. Most of this work was either organized or done by Wayne Dammer, who was Mater D captain there that night and had done a fantastic job on it. We really hope to get a permanent memorial up there at some point. We think it's horrible that you have to trespass to go up there.
Reiterate the name of your book, Tom.
The Beverly Hills Supper Club Fire, The Untold Story Behind Kentucky's Worst Tragedy.
Yeah, well, my hat's off to you guys. You've done a magnificent job. I'm tremendously impressed. You've shown great determination, courage, integrity, intelligence. I'm really blown away. Very impressed. I can't thank you enough. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guests, Tom McConaughey and Dave Bock, for being here, and all of you for watching.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, this is Gary King. Here's a song written when I was just 18. People have always enjoyed this song, and finally, 40 years later, I went ahead and recorded it. If you like it, download it on iTunes. It's called I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat. Gary King. Go to iTunes and download it if you like it.
There's an empty stool right next to me. You know what they say about being without the one you love. But I'm with you, baby, can't you see? Not in love, I'm just in heat.
A song for 40 years played at party after party after party in the city of partying, New Orleans, Louisiana. If you dig it, go to iTunes and download it. I'm not in love, I'm just in heat, Gary King. And I also hope you enjoy the programming we provide here. And if you're into JFK, you can go to my YouTube channel, Gary King at YouTube. And I do a weekly show with Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera. Hope to see you soon.